Welcome to On Deadline, your radio news from Odyssey newsrooms across the country. I'm Christy Strausser, Odyssey's managing editor of news. More than 2,000 people were killed this week in nationwide protests in Iran. The AP reported that dwarfs the death toll from any other round of protest or unrest in Iran in decades and recalls the chaos surrounding the country's 1979 Islamic Revolution. So, what should the United States do about it? Here's more from CBS White House correspondent Aaron Navarro.
We've seen protests in Iran in part due to the worsening economic conditions. And those have been going on for the past week or so. And reports are it's almost 1,000 or more that have been killed by the Iranian security forces. Now, President Trump has repeatedly said that the security forces in Iran killing protesters there could prompt U.S. action. And it seems that we are getting more details on what those options could be in terms of U.S. action. Now, the president has not yet made a final decision, but as you mentioned, his national security team is meeting today. It's unclear on whether the president will attend himself, but it certainly seems like the conversation around what to do from the U.S. side is ramping up.
What could those options include? What are you hearing?
There are many options on the table being presented to President Trump, is what we're being told. Military strikes in Iran through air power and long-range missiles is one option that has been considered. This is notable as U.S. Central Command just opened up a new coordination cell at the Al Udeid Air Base in Qatar, just across the Persian Gulf from Iran. But defense officials also say that cyber operations, or what they call psychological campaigns to demoralize Iran's leadership, is also an option. We know that Vice President Vance and Secretary of State Marco Rubio are involved in the presentation of this array of options to President Trump, including diplomacy, as both the White House and Tehran maintain that diplomatic channels remain open between the two countries, that there is work behind the scenes to set up some sort of meeting. But the president, in his recent comments over the weekend, has seemed to indicate that any U.S. action could still happen before any meeting with the Iranians.
You know, taking military action in Venezuela is one thing, but it seems like it really kind of ups the ante if we start talking about military action in Iran. That's a whole different ballgame.
Yeah, indeed, in part because this is a region of the country that the president has tried to portray himself as a peacemaker in. Though this, you know, should it be another military action, this would be the second that the U.S. has taken on Iran during President Trump's second term, as he struck their nuclear facilities last year. But, you know, Tehran maintains that they are looking to talk to the U.S. in some sort of way. But we will see, as the president is getting hourly updates on the protests, on the killings in Iran, and does not seem happy, to put it lightly.
I guess we can ask you the same question we asked after the Venezuela attack that took out Maduro and took him into custody. I mean, Can the U.S. do this? Can they launch lethal attacks on other countries?
Well, the president said in a recent New York Times interview that the only thing stopping him when it comes to international actions is his own morality. And that's kind of why he's posed this potential action on Iran as a response to the protesters being killed. In terms of any type of, check or balance, it doesn't seem like Congress will do that. You've seen Republicans on Capitol Hill support some sort of action, even military action on Iran, though they are against U.S. boots on the ground. And President Trump did not consult them during the strikes on Iranian nuclear facilities or what happened in Venezuela. So they seem a bit powerless as President Trump weighs his options.
Finally, Aaron, last week the Iranian government shut down internet and cell service in response to these protests. Now, via Starlink, we are being able to see and hear from people in Iran. What kind of stories are we hearing coming out of there?
Hearing a lot of stories of Iranian security forces mowing down protesters, stories of people looking through body bags for family and friends. That internet access is something that President Trump had talked to Elon Musk about, but yes, comes as the communications blackout was instituted by the Iranian leadership.
Tommy Tucker has more on President Donald Trump's reaction to the spiraling problems in Iran.
Joined by our friend Bruce Jenelson, professor of public policy, political science at Duke University, previously worked in the State Department and on the Middle East process. The president was on the plane, so it was kind of hard to understand what he said, but I transcribed it. He said, there seem to be some people killed that aren't supposed to be killed. These are violent. If you call them leaders, I don't know if they're leaders. It's just they rule through violence, but we're looking at it very seriously. The military is looking at it, and we're looking at some very strong options. We'll make a determination. Bruce Jenelson, good morning. How are you?
I'm good, Tommy. Hope you are as well.
Yes, sir. Let's talk about this in relation to what happened during the Arab Spring. First of all, if you can give us a brief reminder of what happened during the Arab Spring. There was some protests in Iran. Iran is Persian, not Arab, just to clear that up right away. You take it from here. Bruce, please.
Yeah. So in 2009, there was what was called the Green Revolution in Iran. I actually was in the Obama administration in the State Department when this was happening. And what happened was the election was stolen from a more reformist, moderate candidate and given to a guy named Ahmadinejad, who, you know, wasn't a religious leader, but ruled very brutally. And the people in the streets kind of rebelled. It ended up being put down. And then we've seen this come time and again. About 2-3 years ago, the Iranian people went to the streets again over the killing of a young woman. And this time, even more people apparently in more parts of the country, not just the big cities, and they're being even more brutally repressed by the government.
So this comes down to whomever rule controls the military controls the government, accurate or not?
Well, you know, it's a country that, since they had their revolution back in 1979, that put the Islamist regime in power and got rid of the Shah, who, by the way, was a pretty repressive leader himself, that we supported because he cooperated with us on foreign policy.
Let me jump in for a second, Bruce, if I may, because we tend to put white hats and black hats on people. And although the Shah played nice with the United States, what was life like for people in Iran under the Shah?
It was pretty bad. He had a secret police called the Savak, and part of the reason he ended up falling and the Islamists coming to power was we very much went along with his repression, and there was no other, like, alternative to opposition, right? We repressed them all. And the then Ayatollah Khomeini was out of the country, came back in, and rallied people around, you know, being anti-Shah, and then they maneuvered out some of the more, you know, secular moderates, and they took power. And so right now you have the son of the Shah, who's been in exile in the United States, who's probably 60, 65 years old, and who's saying, I'm ready to come back. I don't think that's what the Iranian people want. They want to find a way to go forward, not backward.
Is there any way we would ever see a democracy in Iraq, or would they have to get past the theocracy first?
You know, you could find a democracy there over time, but it really depends, as well. You know, you overthrow a leader, and then what happens next often is turmoil, right? And so in Iran, it's interesting. The Iranian population, it probably has had the highest rates of literacy and education of any country in the Middle East except Israel, right? And women have had a role before. They continue to have a role now, repressed by the regime, but still have a role. So the basics are there. The kind of democracy they might have would be very different than we think of it. And to be honest with you, I'm not sure so many countries want to copy us right now. So it would be less repressive. It would be nationalist. It doesn't mean that it would be totally cooperative with the United States. It would still have to work out a relationship with Israel. But the fall of this regime does not necessarily lead to some, you know, Thomas Jefferson or something coming to power.
What is the feeling of the country as it relates to, you know, the religion, the Shah and the theocracy? They rule everything. And I'm just wondering if the people are lapsed in their beliefs or not, or are they as pro-religion, and this is all a terrible way to put all of this, but I think you understand where I'm going with it. Are they as pro-religion as the mullahs would have us think?
Yeah, that's a really good way of putting it, because they're not. You know, this is 40-some-odd years since the revolution, so you've had 2 or 3 generations. And when the revolution first happened, a lot of people said, the Shah was so terrible, so let's try this other way. Well, it's now their kids and grandkids that are there, and they're like, you know, the bad news about the Shah is like old news, right? What I know now is this regime is very repressive in all my life, right? How women have to dress on the streets, what kind of education you get. And they're proud nationalists, you know. In fact, when we bombed Iran in June, It didn't lead to this pro-American outcry. It was like, we don't like this regime, but we don't want anybody coming in here to run our country either.
Bruce, what can the United States do when you come right down to it as far as either aiding people that are protesting or having anything to do with changes in the administration of Iran, et cetera?
Yeah, it's interesting. There are a lot of things that I criticize on President Trump sort of being pretty much of a bully. But in this situation, it's actually helping. It's got the government a little bit, you know, worried, intimidated. But I don't know what military action does here. You know, it's not like you go in and you can snatch the leaders. There are too many of them and it's too spread out. You know, two things. One is this is actually where you really need diplomacy. If we were willing to mobilize our European allies and others from around the world, the Australians, the Japanese, and even some countries that are, you know, sort of so-called global south, to put pressure on this government, then we'd have a real united front, and we'd also benefit from what they know about it. We have not had an embassy there since the hostage crisis back in 79 and 80. And, you know, one of the consequences of that, we don't know much about the country. When I had my security clearances, it was in the State Department in 2009, 2011. The best briefing I got on Iran was from the Australian ambassador to Iran, because he was there, his people were talking to people. So, we may have a couple sources that CIA has, but we don't really know the country well enough to be the ones to figure out, you know, how to make this government fall and what you do on the day after.
How do the other players in the Middle East feel about what's going on in Iran now, and what ideally would they like to see?
So on the one hand, Iran is Shia, and the others, like the Saudis, are Sunni. And we've always seen that as a big, unbridgeable split. The reality is, over the last 3-4 years, the Saudis and the Iranians have started talking to each other. When we bombed Iran in June, despite other good relations with the Saudis said, we're standing by our brother here, our Persian brother. But on the other hand, you know, they all worry, since they're not democracies, about governments falling. And so they kind of don't want to see this government fall because it might affect their people, too.
So when it comes to the divide between Shia and Sunni, is that becoming less and less as people age, people grow up, or is the religion, the fundamentalism still there? I know there will always be radicals, but generally speaking.
They have a lot of shared interests. So you have Saudis, United Arab Emirates, Qatar, all of which are Sunni, have improved their relations with Iran. And they have a lot of interest together. So they're never, you know, the bridges are being built much more than people said was possible, given the Sunni-Shia difference.
Is U.S. military action possible in Iran? WWJ's Kyle Kimball talked with Peter Trumbore, chair of the Department of Political Science at Oakland University.
We're talking Iran here, and another uprising that people have been seeing in the news. This one going on for, what, about 2 weeks?
Yeah, that's about right, yeah.
What was the genesis of this?
It began as a protest around the collapse of the Iranian currency and the general weakness of the Iranian economy and the hardship that that is producing for the Iranian people. And it has really spread to become a countrywide protest movement. Protests in cities across the country, every province, has been affected at this point.
Now, how is this different from past protests? We remember the spring uprising, which was youth driven largely.
Right. So 2009, the so-called Green Movement.
Yes.
During Obama's presidency. And then there were pretty significant protests 3 years ago in 2022. I think what's different this time is it seems to be, and information is hard to come by, right? Because the regime has cut off the country's connections to the internet. It's very difficult for independent information to get out. But what seems to be happening is that this is a much more widespread and broad-based protest movement compared to what we saw in 2009. So I think that that's a big difference. The other thing is that what as near as we can tell, based on the reports of human rights monitoring groups, the civilian death toll is in the hundreds so far, and is expected that could, in fact, get worse, depending upon what happens next.
Is Al-Khamenei in charge of all this? Is he prepared to handle what's coming his way?
Well, I think that they are falling back on the playbook that they are long accustomed to, which is maximum intolerance, and, you know, this sort of effort to cut the country off, to crush opposition and try to continue as if nothing had happened. That seems to be what they're trying to do this time. I did some reading the other day by some folks who really sort of specialize in these kinds of movements and revolutions in particular. And the suggestion that they make is that the conditions in Iran are really ripe for the regime potentially to fall.
Really?
Yes, which is a big change from 3 years ago and a big change from 2009, right? So, again, I haven't followed events closely enough today to be able to give you sort of an independent assessment of whether or not I think that's likely. But folks who really pay attention to this sort of thing are really saying that this is reminiscent of what was happening in 1979 when the Shah's regime was overthrown and replaced with the Islamic Republic. And it's as if now we are seeing a counter-revolution.
If that should happen, what is the U.S.'s liability in all of this in terms of our position in the regional theater?
Well, look, I think we have to tread really carefully. Yeah. I think not as carefully as Obama tread in 2009, right? So back in 2009, President Obama was very reluctant to come out and publicly support the Iranian protesters, in part because the regime was branding the protesters as tools and puppets of the West. And Obama didn't want to fuel that narrative and give the regime even more reason to brutally crack down on their own people. President Trump has certainly said, look, we're willing to use military force if necessary on behalf of the protesters. I mean, I don't know how that could possibly make anything better.
Yeah.
In fact, it could likely make things worse. But we have demonstrated over the last year that we have the capability to strike targets within Iran. But I don't know how you would use, you know, cruise missiles and air power to protect protesters. That seems like there's not a lot of... It doesn't seem to me that there has been a lot of thought given to what a use of American military power under these conditions and circumstances would actually look like.
It wasn't all that long ago, about a year ago, that you and I discussed after the U.S. strikes supposedly annihilated the country Iran's nuclear right. capabilities. Should we be concerned at all about that?
Well, they do not currently have a weapon. We should also be clear that the United States did not completely destroy Iran's
right.
capabilities, right? They still retain the ability to enrich uranium. Certainly, their progress has been set back. But frankly, they're in a better position now than they were when we had the Iran nuclear deal in place. So, you know, again, military power can only get you so far.
Uh-huh.
And in this case, without really any sense of what we would do after that, it's hard for me to understand how this would be at all helpful and why the Iranian protesters would want us to do that.
Uh-huh. Have we heard from Israel at all on this?
Not that I am aware of. What Iran did say today is that should the United States take military action, then they would take military action against both the United States and against Israel. And certainly there are American assets in the region that Iran could strike. They have done so before, both through proxy militias as well as through other means, you know, short and medium range missiles, for example. Iran certainly has the capability to strike Israel. So that's what Iran has said. Iran has also said today that they are willing to engage in diplomacy, but that it would have to be they would have to be treated as equals and it would have to be serious.
Do you think that's possible?
I think the Iranians are willing. I don't know the extent to which we might be. I mean, this is one of those things where the fact that you have Secretary of State Marco Rubio, who is also the National Security Advisor and who now apparently is Viceroy of Venezuela, there are so many other things on his plate.
Yeah.
It's hard for me to know who would actually be in charge of this initiative on our side. So it's one thing for Donald Trump to post things on social media. It's another thing for this government to have a serious plan for what we're actually going to do.
Is President Trump purporting to be the de facto, the acting president of Venezuela?
I think Donald Trump is interested in a lot of things that don't have to do with the messy business of domestic politics right now and domestic policymaking. If you sort of look at how infatuated he has become sure. with variety of foreign policy issues, with military saber rattling, I think that all of this, and honestly, there are, you know, a number of presidents have fallen into this trap of being much more enamored of foreign policy than having to deal with the messiness of working with Congress to actually get things done for the American people. So, you know, it's hard for me to know what Donald Trump is doing besides posting late at night on social media and overseeing renovations to the White House.
Or even not so late at night.
Peter Trumbore is the head of the Department of Political Science, always with a full plate, Peter, I imagine, at Oakland University.
There's a lot going on.
Thank you for coming in. We really appreciate it.
I appreciate you having me.
Thank you for listening to On Deadline, your radio news from Odyssey. On Deadline is written and produced by me, Christy Strasser, and by Lauren Barry. Subscribe wherever you get podcasts.